I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Eva Atanasov, professor of political thought at Bard College Berlin. We're discussing her recent book, Tocqueville's Dilemmas and Ours, from Princeton University Press. Atanasov works on the history of political thought, focusing on questions of nationhood and democratic citizenship, with emphasis on Tocqueville. She is the author of several articles and has co-edited several books on these topics. Well, first of all, Eva Atanasov, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Well, thank you for having me.
Eva, I loved this book. It's a great both analysis of Tocqueville and fresh take, I think, on a very familiar text, Democracy in America, but also bringing in a lot of other texts that I hadn't read. So it's fantastic, but also applying Tocqueville to the contemporary world in interesting ways. So congratulations on the book, first of all. Let me ask you, what was the motivation for writing the book in the first place?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for the kind words. The main motivation was really coming from our contemporary moment, even though the book is a kind of distant offshoot of my dissertation, which I wrote some time ago, 15 years ago, but at the University of Chicago. But really what prompted me to revisit that material was a certain worry about where we are today and what is usually being spoken of as the global crisis of liberal democracy, right? Seeing a certain way of organizing political life and certain ideals and norms coming under attack globally. And so it seemed to me that that's a very urgent concern that way of being and that political form needs to be defended. And also that actually Tocqueville has a lot to say about the current concerns, and that we should tap onto this. We should really draw on a well-known, but on a certain, in a certain way, not well enough known, not sufficiently well-known author, to see how we could actually, he could help us out in thinking through our predicament. So to put it maybe in another way or briefly, right, that there were two motives. On the one hand, to bring out new aspects of a less well-understood aspects of Tocqueville, and to show how they actually speak directly to our situation.
Yeah, that's great. And I want to get to the contemporary, resonance and relevance of Tocqueville maybe near the end. I wanted to start with, I think, where you start, which is a kind of dilemma at the heart of liberal democracy, which may be, kind of familiar to political theorists, but maybe if we just kind of walk through it, which is a kind of, I don't know, you put it in different ways, but a kind of dilemma between the democratic and maybe the liberal sides of liberal democracy. That is, the democratic side, the right to the self-determination of a particular people, particularly to sort of exclude or circumscribe its own boundaries. But then on the other hand, the kind of universality that's implicit in democracy, implicit in liberalism, that sort of, overcomes the limitations of any particular unit. So maybe you could say a little bit about, anything you want about that dilemma, and then, how you think Tocqueville mainly addresses this, or what his main contribution to this could be.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So that's the framing. That's the framing. My way of framing the whole discussion of Tocqueville. The core of the book is really working through Tocqueville's texts, theoretical, analytical, and practical. But I frame that by this looking at the contemporary situation and saying, look, well, whether you take the questions and the kind of most urgent issues that are being discussed today, for instance, immigration, what to do with immigration, or how to how to negotiate global challenges in a world that's divided into nation states and is governed through particular unequal particular formations, right? And so I look at these and I say, well, at the foundation of this current discontent, on the one hand, people saying, well, there is not enough equality. On the other hand, other people saying, well, there is too much globalization, right? So that is watering down particular liberties and really pressuring political systems. So looking at these political and partisan conversations, I kind of try to boil them down or to bring them to this insight that what's at stake here is this tension between two fundamental principles of democracy. And I bring Tocqueville in by saying, well, he had a he starts by a diagnosis or a definition of what modernity is or what modern society is. And he's saying, well, modern society is based on these two principles. On the one hand, on equality, that's really what defines us as moderns, he says, that equality, we are obsessed with equality, and it's enough to open the newspaper or the latest scholarly article and we'll see outcry against inequality and so on. So we are clearly, equality is our creed. But on the other hand, it's also politically speaking, right, it's popular sovereignty, the idea that the people should be sovereign. And these two principles, right, they're the pillars of modern society, but they are in tension, just as you said, that equality doesn't recognize any boundaries, that there is no reason why on this side of the border people should live in such a way and on the other side in a different way, right? That, I mean, there is good historical reasons for this, but we are not accepting these reasons because we believe that all human beings are created equal and endowed by their creator, right? With inalienable rights and so on. So on the one hand, this universalist aspiration and claim, and on the other hand, the political organization, which is that of peoples and nations and borders, and again, the issue of immigration is perhaps the best illustration of how difficult it is to navigate this dilemma. What I'm trying to say is that a lot of the issues today that are coming up are in one way or another playing out this dilemma. And in order to understand how to rise up to the occasion or deal with these issues, it helps to understand these fundamental tensions that underpin, that I claim with Tocqueville, are constitutive of modern society. So we cannot simply look at the circumstances and what it is that's happening and say, okay, we need to address current situation only through the whatever is the most urgent and the latest developments, but we also need to understand, in order to devise wise policies, how the structure of modern society is and why are these tensions. And then these tensions, I want to say, are not that they're ineradicable, right? We cannot be all equal in a kind of literal and maximalist sense, because that would require abolishing different ways of life, which is I don't think is desirable in any way, but it's not even possible, or if possible, not without an enormous amount of violence. And on the other hand, we cannot not take into consideration the claims of equality, this universal claims that are the foundation of modern way of life. So this is just to fast forward toward the end, insofar as I have any recommendations, and I hesitate to have any, right? It's very difficult for a theorist to actually have anything wise to say about policy. But insofar as I have anything to say about policy, is to say, well, that needs to be navigated. There has to be a constant negotiation of these principles rather than desire to for final solutions. And I use this phrase advisedly, although not without provocation. Yes.
Yeah, just as a kind of clarification here, because I realized, you know, I sort of glossed the dilemma in terms of like a dilemma between liberty and equality or liberalism and democracy, but But it seems like Tocqueville is thinking about the dilemma in terms of like of a dilemma that's kind of within the principle or emerges from the principle of equality itself, right? Or that it's internal to democracy itself. That is, that democracy gives rise out of its principle of equality of a claim to a certain kind of rule that is a rule of popular sovereignty that's particularistic in nature, but it also like spills out over that particular community to the equality of all human beings. Is that right? I mean, to think of it as the kind of dilemma that's particularly on the principle of equality. I ask in part because, you know, if it's sort of a dilemma that's internal to a single principle itself, rather than trading off against different principles, then the task is even more pointed and more difficult, right? Because you're sort of working within a single principle. Is that the right way to think about it?
Well, you could think about it this way, right? But another way of saying is it much depends how you define equality. And here, I mean, maybe pointing to another piece I published recently about contrasting Tocqueville and Schmitt. So somebody like Carl Schmitt would come and say, well, people misunderstand equality, democratic equality, and they make it, the liberals misunderstand it, they believe it's universal, but in fact it's particular. Equality is about the equality of the people. So he kind of says, we call it, yes, equality, yes to equality, but it's equality within the boundary of the people rather than across that boundary. So that could be one way of defining what democratic equality is, and you can, you know, you can understand or translate one of the three dilemmas that I'm kind of pointing to as being the dilemma of how to define or how to gloss or how to operationalize democratic equality. But partly what I'm saying is that every modern society, whether it's liberal or not liberal, has to deal with these tensions. And so that's, you know, looking at this, and I kind of listed or parse it out into three dilemmas, right? The first dilemma is how to construe the principle of popular sovereignty, which, you know, it can be construed in a way that the people should really actively participate in government, or the people are just invoked in some elite body tells the people what their interests are and how they should live. So bottom-up versus top-down could be one way of putting it. How to mobilize or allegiance to the political people, or to the people, or to the nation. And the question of nationalism is, how do we actually mobilize civic allegiance and loyalty and make people actually sustain the political order rather than oppose it or undermine it? And the third is how to negotiate the processes of globalization, which I describe us or try to use Tocqueville to point out that there are democratic, that globalization is a democratic phenomenon, right? It's a kind of driven by democratic dynamics. And so all three of these are dilemmas of modern society, and each modern society, independently of I claim, right, of what political regime is in place, needs to deal with them one way or another. And so these dilemmas, as you say, they're internal to modern society, not to liberal democracy. Liberal democracy, I want to say, is one particular way of dealing with them, right? Of dealing with these dilemmas. This is the kind of take I reached toward the end of writing the book. I started with a much more sort of schematic way. Oh, this is liberal, is one way of, yeah, and a liberal another, but it seemed to me that you cannot have a liberal society or liberal democracy that is not both egalitarian and have a certain very robust understanding of popular sovereignty, that is really committed to self-government. And if you have commitment to self-government, then you need a strong sense of self, a strong sense of who the people are, what makes us part of these people, in this case, American, right? And that kind of loyalty and allegiance is part and parcel of liberal democracy, not something that's external to it.
Right. And that's that's quite interesting, because then the, you know, I mean, Tocqueville is relevant not just to liberal democracies, say, in the U.S. and Western Europe, but it's, you know, it could be relevant to China. We were talking just before, you're working on a project in China and Tocqueville and Russia, North Korea, even. I mean, a lot of these regimes, they speak in terms of popular sovereignty. I mean, the legitimation of even authoritarian regimes is cash out in terms of what the people want. So there's a way in which, you know, Tocqueville's analysis then is relevant not just to liberal democracies but also to authoritarian regimes. Is that the right way to draw that out?
Well, I think mentioning China, that's the best evidence. They're obsessed. You know, they often, the phrase that has become almost technical is the Tocqueville craze. Right? Tocqueville is one of the best-selling books. I mean, interestingly, in China, in mainland China, they focus on the old regime, and that has reasons. They're not so keen on democracy in America. But the old regime is a top... It's in the top 10 books that the Chinese Communist Party has recommended to its people. And it and probably Tocqueville sales in China outstrip anything anywhere else. But of course, again, but they go to Tocqueville and they use Tocqueville for their own purposes. So that's another conversation, right? How they read Tocqueville, but definitely.
Yeah, that's great.
No, about North Korea. I don't know that anyone knows.
Maybe he hasn't reached there. Yeah, Tocqueville hasn't reached there yet. Good. Well, I want to get into Tocqueville and your three dilemmas. Maybe you could say a little bit just off the top about Tocqueville scholarship and where you see yourself in Tocqueville scholarship. I mean, there's just sort of a ton of work that's been done on Tocqueville in the past 25 years or so. I mean, how do you see yourself as sort of contributing to that body of work?
Mm-hmm. Well, I draw on it as much as possible. And one of the things I'm most proud of is the first blurb by Arthur Goldhammer, who calls that, exhaustively researched book. I don't think that's possible to do with Tocqueville scholarship. You know, there's so much of it. It's a veritable industry. So I do not claim to have a comprehensive view, but I do claim to really fill in some notable gaps. For instance, I was shocked to see that how little there was in terms of thematic, sustained scholarly treatment of Tocqueville and popular sovereignty. For, you know, Tocqueville and equality, that's a minefield, right? Or that's a huge a mountain of different takes, but Tocqueville and popular sovereignty, very few, and some of them very recent. So, and that I couldn't quite understand, given that that's chapter 4 of Democracy in America, very prominently up there early in the book. True, short chapter, so you know, but then he says at the beginning of chapter 5, you know, every chapter in this book is an application of this principle. So Tocqueville again calls attention to the importance of this, and to see that how little it's been treated in the literature was a genuine surprise to me. And of course, some degree of satisfaction going with it, that hey, I'm onto something. The second theme, that nationalism is a well-established one in Tocqueville studies. I mean, there's been a lot of contributions and thinking about what Tocqueville says about nationhood and nationalism, but I haven't seen or haven't noticed, haven't come across any attempt to make a systematic treatment out of it, either a single book or a kind of sustained treatment. Okay, here's how different things that Tocqueville says fit together, and you know that amounts to something, rather than typically the take is, well, yes, Tocqueville is nationalistic in his politics, and that's incompatible with his, you know, support for liberal democracy, and that's typically the take. There are some attempts to say no, nationalism and liberalism are actually not mutually exclusive for Tocqueville or otherwise, but I've tried to develop these and really show that there is a kind of almost a theoretical understanding in Tocqueville about a modern nationhood and nationalism, or an important and interesting contribution that Tocqueville makes to the discussion, again, its own, which is its own industry of nationalism. And then finally, globalization, that's mainly the most, perhaps the most provocative or controversial aspect of the book. Yes, to make Tocqueville speak about globalization might be in itself very provocative or counterintuitive, because we believe globalization is a relatively recent term, and people think that if it's a recent term, that it must be also a recent phenomenon. And partly what I'm saying there is that this kind of global push of democracy, the push beyond the national boundaries, and the kind of expansionism that goes with it, ideological, economic, political, is, first of all, not a new phenomenon. It's a long durée, as the historians say. But also, Tocqueville has a lot to say about this, even if he doesn't use our vocabulary. So this here, again, I mean, not entirely new or the first to say anything about this. I draw on a very substantial debate about Tocqueville and empire, and Tocqueville's comparative frame. But I think I frame that somewhat differently than the rest of the scholarship that I'm familiar with.
Yeah, I think you bring out the ambivalence much more in Tocqueville on empire than what I've seen. So we'll get there. So let's talk first about popular sovereignty and the dilemma Tocqueville sees around popular sovereignty. As you say, it's a theme that comes right near the beginning of democracy in America. So maybe you could just sort of, you know, develop Tocqueville's view of popular sovereignty and how he thinks it gets manifested in American life, and what the challenges are that he seeks to navigate.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe it will be helpful to start from our current sort of concern with populism, right? And in a way, seeing popular sovereignty today when it's talked about, and I think the term has had a comeback thanks to populism and an attempt to understand where that comes from. So we typically today, we tend to see popular sovereignty as intention or the opposite of constitutionalism. Popular sovereignty is the power of the people, the claim that majorities have the right to direct societies, whereas constitutions or constitutionalism usually is the attempt to embed in law fundamental rights of individuals and minorities, and thus establish limits on what these majorities can decide. And so it's very often sort of popular sovereignty, understood as majoritarian rule, is pitted against constitutionalism as a understood as legal protection or the rule of law, and the limits put on popular power. I'm starting with Tocqueville's account of popular sovereignty, partly to push against that narrative. So my part of what I want to show is that, well, that constitutionalism and popular sovereignty for Tocqueville are mutually constitutive, or the two sides of the same, certainly historically in the United States, or in the kind of founding, the coming into being of American society, they were working together, right? So, and he has a kind of historical account, a kind of quick recap of the colonial beginnings, but then, and also in that chapter specifically on popular sovereignty of the revolutionary period, where he says, well, what was already in place, the kind of culture of self-government, a political culture, was then sort of comprehended in law in these constitutional experiments, and the foundational principle there, what he calls the law of laws of the American regime, is the sovereignty of the people. And then toward the end of the chapter, he has this sentence that he basically says, well, sometimes the people as a body make the laws in Athens, and in other times they send deputies, and so he sees representative institutions and direct institutions, which he famously discovers in the township, right, the kind of immediate democracy, as two aspects of the same, or as applications of the same principle, rather than two different things. And so he sees all kinds of American institutions, and he appreciates the diversity that he discovers in the United States of different institutional forms as applications of popular sovereignty that are somehow tailored to the particular occasion and circumstances. And I am talking about this because I want to, and then he eventually gets to the federal constitution and discusses that at great length, and especially, and also to the Supreme Court. And he's saying, he's in each time, he's pointing out how what makes these institutions viable is the popular commitment to them. And so he shows how popular sovereignty and these sort of supposedly limiting institutions and the rule of law are, the, as I was saying, the two sides of the same coin. So on the one hand, there is the continuity between these two things. But on the other hand, there is also the tension. And in that chapter, in every chapter, I have this what I call case studies, right? Where Tocqueville really looks at practical political problem and tries to apply different analytical understandings to it. So the case study of this chapter is the so-called nullification crisis, which he actually personally witnesses, because that's the time where he's in the United States. And that's the most significant crisis of sovereignty prior to the Civil War. And so he sees sees a moment in which popular power, we can say, the kind of mobilization of understanding of what the people are, who the people are, and how popular power should play out, pushing against the Constitution, I mean, pushing against the constitutional principles and undermining the constitutional consensus. And so I use this to say, yes, popular sovereignty and constitutionalism are the two sides of the same coin, but what makes constitutions work, and this is our dilemma today, why are constitutions being sort of eroded and respect for law is kind of, and trust in institutions, it's plummeting. And what they rely on, what makes them viable, is this a broad-based allegiance, right? And broad-based sense of belonging to we the people, to the opening words of the Constitution. And so to the kind of national sense of belonging. That brings me to the next chapter, right? To the nationhood problem. So in order to reconcile that tension between popular sovereignty and rule of law, I'm saying the crucial link is this sense of being in the same boat and being one nation and one people. And that's what is making constitutionalism work. And that's not very often said, especially in constitutionalists and legal circles, because legal scholars tend to look at the law, and then scholars of nationalism tend to look only at nationalism. And I'm trying to link together these two literatures in a way through Tocqueville and point out the connection between them.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's sort of dynamic interactive character between the two, reciprocal, interaction between sovereignty and law is very useful to think about. I mean, especially is sort of contrasting with other figures, which you also do in this chapter. I mean, so for example, Rousseau, there's much more of a sense that it's either one direction or another, right? So it's either, the legislator sort of stamping the people with a particular identity based on giving the people a certain kind of laws, or it's the popular will that sort of dismisses the government or, keeps the government on. Whereas Tocqueville, I take it, this is the point that there's a constant sort of dynamic interaction that needs to be managed, that can never be fully solved, right? There's no play. You can't point, in other words, you can't point to like, here's where popular sovereignty is, but it's constantly, exists or emerges out of this interactive relationship. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Let me add two more things about this. One is, yes, you mentioned Rousseau. Rousseau is one interlocutor here, and Madison is the other main one, right? Madison is being the kind of stand-in for the collective founders and for the kind of spirit and theory of the American founding, which Tocqueville is learning from. He's taking from the Federalists with both hands, but he's also at a critical distance to them. And what he's pointing out to somebody like Madison or to Federalist 10 and 51, all right, for instance, is that you cannot simply have diversity and or size take the place of virtue and civic virtue, right, and shared loyalty to the people. And so the sense of we the people is not a spontaneous thing that somehow automatically rises off from the institutional structure, but needs to be cultivated and sustained. And that's the Rousseau part, right? So Tocqueville comes out, or my reading of Tocqueville, he comes out as surprisingly, or perhaps not so surprisingly, Rousseauian, but very strongly Rousseauian. And maybe one more point about this, I wasn't aware of it when I was writing this chapter, but later in conversations with scholars, more historically minded scholars, especially historians of France, is that this whole rhetoric of popular sovereignty in the French context immediately brought to mind the convention and the Jacobins, right? You talk about popular sovereignty in the French context, you're basically talking about the Jacobins. And so for Tocqueville to valorize, to reclaim this concept and to say, well, that's a fundamental concept of modern society or modern democracy, is in a way to validate an aspect of the French experience that his own family suffered from immensely, right? His family was decimated in the terror. But he's seeing that this concept of popular sovereignty, you cannot understand the modern experience or talk about modern democracy without grappling with this concept, and that it's a, or with this aspiration. And it's a challenge, right? It can go very badly, as it did in the later part of the French Revolution, or the terrorist moment, but it also could go well. And he's seeing in America, right, a way in which you can actually have popular rule that is worthy of the name, well, with qualifications. Yes, that is something that he can endorse and even recommend to the French.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's just one last question on the sovereignty point. My memory from this chapter in Democracy in America on Popular Sovereignty is he sort of criticizes kind of divided sovereignty, calls it a, you know, kind of chimera. I was wondering about that because it seems like, you know, it's hard to square Tocqueville's commitment to kind of, or at least in my head, you can maybe help me with this, but square his commitment to a kind of unified view of popular sovereignty with his very kind of pluralistic view of how that sovereignty manifests itself in a, you know, multitude of different townships and all these kinds of mediating institutions and this like federated structure. And there are lots of places where popular sovereignty can manifest itself, but it's not really unified in any certain way. It's actually quite pluralistic and maybe not divided. So maybe this is the sort of nationalism point. The next point we'll turn to is the kind of solution to it, that popular sovereignty is something that's sort of created. It doesn't precede, you know, political activity and political structure. But do you see my sort of confusion here? I'm not, you know, the sort of commitment to unified popular sovereignty with a kind of pluralistic manifestation of it.
Well, this is the debate with Madison that I mentioned, right? And it's also my debate with the majority of Tocqueville scholarship, who tend to read him as an anti-sovereigntist thinker, just because he is for associations, he is for pluralism, he is for this kind of people, of citizens stepping into the public square and sort of participating in a variety, in a myriad ways, and so these the diversity of civic forms. So all this is true, but the question is, and this is why the nullification crisis is so important in my view in making the case, is to show that, well, yes, pluralism is great, but unless you have, right, unless you have something that holds it together, unless you have this shared sense of, okay, we go about it in different ways, we have different views, perhaps even of the common good, but there is something that holds us together. And so we are not separating, or we are not fighting one against the other, which was what happened in the nullification crisis, is that South Carolina was actually arming up and ready, right, to sort of declare, or at least threatened, right, to declare secession, which eventually happened, right? So how, what is it, right? What are the conditions? In other words, there are always two dragons, right? Or two evils in between which a good democracy needs to steer. And one evil is the totalizing despotic, or the kind of top-down situation, or centralism.
Right, the French worry, right?
What Tocqueville identified with the French sort of illness or their excessive desire for centralizing everything. And he's famously against state centralization, or what he calls administrative centralization. Maybe I need to clarify that. But the other end is disintegration, right? And he sees, he now, so there is a little discussion of sovereignty, kind of theorizing sovereignty in the race chapter, that very few people look at, because that's laid into when he's looking at the, what are the prospects that the American Union will last. And that's part of the race chapter that is, I think, universally ignored these days, where he talks about the current politics, Jacksonian America, and so on. And then he gives a little theory of sovereignty, and he says, you know, actually unified republics, they have this tendency toward excessive centralization, but federal republics like the United States, they have the other tendency toward disintegration. And so that's where the Americans need to look, right? They're all obsessed with centralization, but they actually have to be careful about the other extreme. So I look at his discussion of centralization and point out what he distinguishes between political centralization and administrative centralization. He's very much, again, administrative, but he says political centralization is the foundation of a modern statehood. You cannot have a modern state without that. So he's very much for political centralization, but against administrative centralization. And then comes the difficulty. What's the difference, right? Where is the boundary? How do we know that we've crossed from the good kind of centralization into the bad kind? So that's a typical dilemma situation, right? Where you don't simply want to say, no, we don't want centralization, but you also don't want to say we want all of it, right? We need to find a moderate balance. And that moderate balance means, yes, pluralism, but also, yes, we need a common, right? We need something that holds us together. And the question is, how do we contain this pluralism so that it doesn't explode the political order or tear it apart?
That's great. Yeah, that's very helpful. So let's turn to the next chapter on nationalism. So that nationalism plays the role, in your view, for Tocqueville as this kind of integrating force or mechanism bring a community together. So maybe you could kind of talk through, you know, the kind of challenges and tensions that emerge in terms of nationalism. One of the things that you focus on is the notion of national pride, which is Tocqueville doesn't use the term nation or nationalism, right? He would use the term peoplehood.
He does use the word nation.
Oh, he does. Okay.
Uh-huh. Nationality. What he doesn't use is nationalism. That's my kind of
much later. Yeah.
Import. It gains currency later in the century, right? Uh-huh. And so that's not in his vocabulary, but he uses nation, nationality, people and nation interchangeably, which is also something that changes in common parlance later on. And now nowadays we tend to distinguish these two and talk about nationalism versus populism as very two different phenomena, whereas he's still very much in the kind of using them together or patriotism.
Right. Yeah, the patriotism point, especially he has a chapter on contrasting ancient and modern forms of patriotism, right? And democracy in America. I'm not trying to remember if you discussed that part. Part of the point is my memory is that, you know, for Tocqueville's contrasting the sort of very fervent form of civic virtue that exists in the ancient world versus the modern form of patriotism that's much more, you know, much thinner, based on kind of self-interest, rightly understood, and so forth. In any case, maybe you want to sort of take up the discussion there, how Tocqueville thinks about nationalism here.
Right. So I connect the leading to the nationalism discussion is the argument in the Populist Sovereignty chapter that a shared sense of belonging to we the people is indispensable to hold a democratic society together, right? It's a kind of indispensable source of democratic legitimacy. And so I turn to the question of nationhood or nationalism with this understanding, and I distinguish here between nationhood, that is a kind of moral identity or maybe shared ethical view of shared way of life, perhaps common customs, right, that I say, according to Tocqueville, is universal. He talks about aristocratic nations, right? For him, nations didn't begin in 1789, as many modern historians tend to say, right? Nations, there was no such thing in the pre-modern world. And for Tocqueville, it's not at all, right? Every political community has a form of nationhood. But what is distinctly modern, I argue, is nationalism. And nationalism is, even though that's not Tocqueville's word, but I kind of extract it from his analysis, is an argument that equates the nation with the whole of society and makes it into the locus precisely of sovereignty and of civic allegiance. So where the pre-modern, or as he's looking at the monarchical state, the allegiance was to the king, right? And sovereign was this the monarch. So here the sovereign is the people, and allegiance is to the people. And so we need a kind of sense of who these people are. We need a story who they are. We need a sense why they deserve our allegiance. And this kind of story and argument is the substance of nationalist ideology. And I want to say that nationalism is only possible in an egalitarian society, and it's uniquely necessary in a political order based on the principle of the sovereignty of the people. So to think about, this is partly arguing against ideas very, very popular in Europe, for instance, today, is that democracy is incompatible with nationalism, that nationalism is something like an aberration or something that needs to be transcended. And I'm saying, no, just as popular sovereignty and constitutionalism are mutually constitutive, so too nationalism and democracy are actually the two sides of the same coin. But that doesn't yet answer the question, what kind of nationalism or what kind of argument for loyalty to the people and for belonging is conducive or can foster a liberal democracy, right? I'm just saying liberal democracy, like any other democracy, needs nationalism, but what kind is the crucial question. So to sort that out, I look at his discussion of patriotism that you mentioned, pre-modern and modern, and partly why I'm less interested, again, partly for polemical reasons, but also in order to point out things that are not often observed. I'm less interested in the contrast that everyone's pointing out and that Tocqueville accentuates than in the similarity in these two sort of attitudes that Tocqueville analyzes. And what I point out is that they're both grounded in mechanisms of identification. I use here very often used phrase, the kind of imagined community, right? That what nationalism, what patriotism of any kind presupposes is a vision of what the community is, and how, you know, and a sense of being part of it. And that's more or less an imaginary thing. We're not obviously able to know the entire nation. We know a few people around, but we have an imagined imagined community in mind when we identify with it. And so mechanisms of identification and with king in the pre-modern case that Tocqueville analyzes, or people in the modern case. And also the other kind of common thing that I noticed is that they're both grounded in pride, that what patriotism actually thrives on is a kind of prideful affirmation of a collective identity, right? The pre-moderns, where they were proud of their king, they were proud even to be oppressed by their king, because they thought, well, that was the great king of the greatest king in the world. That's what the old French said, according to Tocqueville. And the modern peoples, and some modern peoples have similar feelings about the leaders. But modern Americans say, well, we are proud of the people, we're proud to be American. And so I pull out some quotes where that pride is really pointed out by Tocqueville, right? He says, this is the vital psychological foundation of American civic spirit, this profound sense of pride of satisfaction of being part of this new thing, of this new community that is this new democracy. And this is what makes these citizens, so I'm trying to get to the foundations of the civic spirit, what makes citizens really actively contribute to the common good, go out of their way, as Tocqueville says, you know, they don't start writing letters to the government, come fix this and that. They spontaneously organize, at least once upon a time, or at least in his idealized version of it, organize and dedicate extra time to advance the common good. And so this shared identification and pride is what I'm pointing out, this shared psychology of patriotism, sort of qualifies the profound distinction that is often pointed out between pre-modern and modern patriotism. But it also points out that this modern patriotism is not without its problems, right? So I'm partly interested in pointing out that it's morally speaking a problematic thing, because pride is a problematic thing. Well, if you're a Christian, pride is the first of the original sin, right? The capital sin. And even politically, I mean, if you think about Hobbes's Leviathan, right, Hobbes erects this enormous monster, and as he quotes from the Book of Job, right, that's the only way that the king over the children of pride, that's the only way to contain this enormous pride. That is the political problem that Hobbes sees. So pride is problematic. But again, I want to argue, just because it's problematic doesn't mean that we can do without it. And so then I turned in my case study in this chapter is a particular moment in Tocqueville's own political career where he made one especially prideful speech in defense of France. I can recount the story in more detail if you wish, but that causes an international scandal, and then and a very famous exchange between Mill and Tocqueville about national pride, in which Tocqueville says, well, you know, yes, pride is a problem, but that's what holds us together as a people. That's exactly that, the sense that the pride of the name that we bear, and we need to be protective of this feeling because that's the main civic resource. And yes, it can go easily astray and can do terrible things, and that needs to be somehow held in check and educated, but we cannot do without national pride. And that's partly what I'm trying to say. Well, liberals, or those who want to defend liberal democracy, cannot simply say, well, nationalism bad, right? And turn the other way. Or they have to say, yes, they are bad forms of nationalism, but that makes the burden is on us to come up with something more decent and better.
Yeah, that's very useful, especially the exchange with Mill was a great part of this chapter, because it really did help, I think, solidify the evidence that, you know, Tocqueville is a defender of a certain kind of, you know, patriotic spirit here. It's of a particular kind, though. I mean, I guess I wanted to push you just a little bit on thinking about the role of self-interest, rightly understood, in this context, because at least, you know, at least it, maybe, I guess if I can think of the contrary view, is something like the idea that, you know, a sense of, the sense of sort of civic virtue is not produced through sentiment, but it's produced through reflection. It's a different sort of psychological mechanism on the part of the citizen. And it's a reflection that, well, if I, you know, follow the rules and commit myself to the common good, it will benefit me, right? So it's very different than a kind of identification. I guess, you know, maybe you could, I mean, Tocqueville does have this account, important account of self-interest rightly understood around these kind of chapters. I mean, do you see that as kind of running concurrently in terms of the psychological mechanisms, or do you think that's kind of, you know, like overblown as an explanation here?
I think Tocqueville does have that, right? Definitely, that modern patriotism is more reflective, is more utilitarian, and is more self-interested than the Asian one, the pre-modern one. And it's not the Asian one, because the ancient, so, right, the reason why it's not the ancient one is because he connects pre-modern and modern patriotism in that particular discussion to monarchy and republic. And he calls it, one is monarchical and the other is republican. And so that opens the question, what were ancient republics like and what ancient patriotism was like? And that's somewhat separate. But in that specific discussion, he contrasts the French under the old monarchy versus the Americans. And yes, the American patriotism, he says, is more calculating, it's more reflective. But then, and that seems to be like a good thing in that particular discussion. But then later, when he looks at what are the chances that the American Union will last, and where he's really skeptical about that, right? He kind of predicts secession. And he has this moment and says, well, the Americans, they claim that it's in their interest to protect the union, but I don't believe that self-interest is going to help them, because interests change, right? So he has here praise of reflective and self-interested patriotism, there being skeptical that that's enough of a resource. And that has led some scholars to say, well, Tocqueville is the most contradictory author. He contradicts himself on consecutive pages. Go figure, right? And so I've tried to figure out why is he saying different things in these different moments. And I think partly it's because he always recognizes two sides to things, right? And he recognizes the virtue of the American political culture on the one hand, but also the vulnerabilities of it. And in one place he discusses the one aspect, and in another the other aspect. But also because, if you remember, in that digging into that psychology deeper, I end up with something like, perhaps too often I abuse this word, but something like a dialectic, right? And in that, for Tocqueville, in order for psychological attitude to really be powerful, I claim, and again, I try to prove that with text, is that it needs to be instinctive, right? It needs to be actually absorbed and really, so identification is really necessary. But it's also dangerous, precisely in the kind of ways that we can imagine, a kind of knee-jerk, thoughtless, irrational, and destructive ways. So, and he sees that in the American case, he could see a kind of conversation going on. On the one hand, the individualism, the kind of, the Americans are very individualistic, and they want to think about their interests a lot, and that's a good thing, because that puts a rational check on collectivist attitudes. But of course, it could also be bad. It becomes corrosive, and what he calls individualism and critiques in volume two, right? So that can be taken to an extreme. On the other hand, you need this collective identification, and he sees that the South has it in a very strong way, and the North has it in a strong way, but they don't quite share it in his analysis of North and South. And he sees a kind of cleavage there, a kind of moral abyss that or difference that will be very difficult in his view. He just doesn't see how this could be politically managed without some kind of conflict. And and why he wasn't entirely right about the nature of this conflict. I think that was very prescient on his part to see that, you know, it wouldn't be an easy reconciliation.
Yeah, I think this is great. I mean, it's seems to me, I mean, you can have both psychological mechanisms at work at the same time, both a reflective and a sentimental attachment. I mean, these don't seem to me to be necessarily in conflict, but indeed, I mean, I think this is the brilliant part of your analysis. I mean, that there is a dynamic relationship at work here. That is, that the sort of reflective side of modern democracy can check the sort of irrational sentimental side, but the sentimental side can also be a kind of engine and source of energy and collective belonging that maybe could it in the more attenuated reflective side doesn't work. So I think that, yeah, so I'm only convinced. So let's talk about the third dilemma here, the final dilemma in your book about globalization. And the transition here is interesting. I mean, in the sense that for Tocqueville, kind of national pride is necessarily international in nature, because national pride has to come from national greatness, which has to come from a kind of necessary interaction with others such that you're recognized by other nations, that you can't be sort of sequestered on your own, divided from the international community and still have a kind of national pride. And it drives globalization on Tocqueville's view. So maybe you could sort of talk through Tocqueville's analysis here of globalization. You draw a lot on works here that haven't been translated into English. It's very illuminating for me, Tocqueville's sort of analysis of foreign policy, French foreign policy, his view of colonialism. So maybe, you know, sort of highlight for us the sort of main features of Tocqueville's view of globalization and what he takes to be the dilemmas that emerge.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, so I think this is in many ways the most problematic chapter because, well, problematic, perhaps controversial, and I'm hoping it will provoke debate and also interest in Tocqueville's foreign policy, which I don't see much, right? As you said, the majority of these works of his writings on foreign policy, which are policy papers, policy briefs, have not been translated. A slice has been is available in English under the rubric of colonization, but even that is highly selective, and it has skewed the debate in a certain way. So part of my goal here in this chapter is to provide a corrective and broaden that discussion of Tocqueville on colonialism and empire. So what am I arguing? So in the end of the, toward the end of the nationalism chapter, I say that national identity and pride, or what we just talked about, are some kind of crucial resources for liberal democratic politics. And then I point out that these resources cannot be sustained simply from within, right? That this is not enough. Institutional design is not going to take care of it. Right, or even some kind of very dedicated civic education or campaign or something like this. That ultimately identity is based on sense of distinction and on saying, well, we are this and they are that, right? And this we-they distinction comes up for critique nowadays a lot, right? That's a bad thing, but it's not simply a bad thing. It's an indispensable thing, right? Any sense of self is based on a sense of who I am not. In fact, Freud begins with saying, well, that's our first move, distinguish ourselves from the environment and from the mother, right? So that sense of a distinction is indispensable for
and what we can do well too, right?
Yes.
In contrast and to others.
Exactly. Yes, not only how we are different, but in what way? Yes, that's the other thing I discuss. So I have this whole analysis of pride as an attitude and as an emotion, and what pride is socially speaking. It's a social passion, and it's based not only on these social comparisons, but also on a very evaluative, right, very normatively laden sense of comparison. We always seek to say, well, we're different, and that's a good here, and that's a in a good way, right? In a way that comes that presents us in a good light. So that kind, so national identity cannot be simply produced from within. It needs this kind of external mirror, just as an individual identity requires a social mirror. So a national identity requires this kind of sense of who we are in the world. What is it that we contribute and present and do well or better? And this need, right? This need for coherent national identity is part of what pushes democracies outward, right? And they are looking for not only for, so here I contrast Tocqueville with the vision outlined in the Communist Manifesto, right? So for Marx and Engels, and this is the typical understanding of globalization, that's economic phenomenon. We go out in the search of new markets, capitalism, you know. But I'm saying, just as, you know, democracies or modern societies go out in the search of new markets, they go out in the search of new moral resources and new ways of self-understanding. And then I use this phrase from Christopher Brown's book, Moral Capital, right? Partly to play out of the Marxist analysis. And this seems to me, I mean, I haven't seen, I'm not a specialist of globalization in this sense. This chapter is probably, in terms of research, under-researched. I don't fully have an overview, but I haven't seen any kind of argument along those lines, or very little, about modern globalization, right? The modern globalization typically is a field dominated by economists and talking about markets and institution and economic institutions. So partly what I'm trying to say is that aspects of democratic society, and especially this also the need for identity, but also the issue of equality, are drivers of this of globalization. And that means that sovereignty, national sovereignty, and national identity are not simply opposite to globalization, right? They're again this kind of dialectical or dynamic tie that makes them mutually, right? They're both continuous and in tension at the same time. But that means that any easy kind of dichotomy, sovereignty, either sovereignty or global, right, institutions are inadequate, right? We need to see the complexity of this relationship, both in political and in moral and economic terms as well. And then I look at Tocqueville's colonial writings as a case study for this chapter. And this is, you know, Tocqueville made foreign policy as his most important. He was active 11 years in parliament. He's often considered to be an ineffectual politician. I believe that's completely overdrawn. I think he was quite effectual, as far as I could see. Well, he was long, long time in politics, and he was active in very all fields of domestic and foreign affairs, but he made foreign relations his privileged interest, and he even has notes about this, that this is the most important thing. If the ministry is doing well in foreign politics, I'm not going to, quarrel with them. He has a sense that for modern society, this international politics is extremely important, because this is where the whole national identity, the whole self perception of a modern people is being forged and sustained. And also he has a very vivid sense of these geopolitical preconditions for liberal politics at home. And here I developed this idea of balance of power, international balance of power, as a kind of parallel and parallel to the internal checks and balances of any regime, but also preconditions for liberal politics at home. And so he's very, we would say, I mean, again, back to the speech and the controversy with Mill, he was kind of hawkish. He was very much urging France to be actively involved in foreign policy, and his rhetoric draws these comparisons, right? We know Tocqueville argued that democratic citizens need to be active actively, you know, involved in political life in order to be fully developed as individuals, right? He worried about this kind of isolationism and individualism. And he said, well, the same is true of democratic nations, right? When they become self-involved and isolationist, then they risk they put their liberty at risk. Why? Because other players are going to take, you know, charge of world politics and really cripple or undermine the conditions of their own liberty. And so he was very much urging France to be actively involved in foreign affairs, and especially to balance England, who was the kind of hegemon at the time, or aspiring global leader, and saying, well, France needs to balance England in order to preserve her own sovereignty and her own freedom. What that active participation means is very much contextual. And the context of the 19th century was this enormous expansionism, right? England's colonial expansion, but also, and that's a part of the chapter, right, the anti-slavery politics, the kind of abolitionism that England made its staple, maybe number one foreign policy objective. And so how should France relate to that? That's what partly what I'm discussing there. And the other big political cause or foreign policy cause that Tocqueville had was Algeria, and his participation in partly as a wannabe architect of Algerian colonization is very well discussed in the literature. But as you say, in the literature, he's presented as this militant, colonialist, belligerent sort of conquistador. And I just don't see any of this. I just don't know where people are taking this from, right? And partly they're taking this from because they cannot see how a liberal could be in favor of colonization. And maybe that's what is driving this misperception. But also, I think partly because not all of his writings here have been translated, and so there's only a partial view. But what I see is a very, very, as you said, ambivalent hawk. On the one hand, he's not saying let us go and conquer ourselves a new land, right? That's not what he's saying. He's more like, I don't know, John McCain saying, okay, we're in Iraq, so what do we do with that, right? What is our responsibility here? What is our responsibility both to the people that we have conquered and to ourselves? What is our historical responsibility as a nation?
And particularly, I mean, I was interested the point in about the Algeria case is, you know, Tocqueville advocates for a kind of, you know, increasing the capacities of self-government of the Algerian people, right? I mean, there's takes from Democracy in America the idea that, you know, in order to have a tyrannical system won't work. You need to sort of engender a kind of self-government, which cuts against the usual account of a kind of colonizing power, right?
Well, yes and no, because it also goes hand in hand with a sense, well, these people are very distinct. They're not going to take French law, right? For them, French law, what for us is freedom, for them is tyranny, right? So he's very clear. So partly what's missing in a colonial situation is precisely a shared we, right? So when people talk about, oh yeah, but rule of law, the first question is whose law, right? If it's French law, they're not going to take it. So they want to live under their own law. But how do we have a system in which different groups live under different law? This is precisely what colonial society is. And this is precisely why I argue, if you look closely into Tocqueville's analysis, he's saying it's not going to work, right? It just cannot work. Because in a modern society, which is based on equality and popular sovereignty, right, neither of these could be fulfilled in a colonial context, right? Neither equality, because there will be differential legal systems. And when you have different legal systems, one is superior and the other is inferior, that this kind of hierarchy spontaneously happens. It's not only happens, it's installed. And also there is not one people, right? There is not a sense of belonging to the same society that can provide legitimacy for this system. So he's saying, and I quote his letters, which saying, well, sooner or later, you know, that's going to fall apart. But in the meantime, right, what can we do, right? What can we do to develop this society and to build a kind of, right, he recommends nation building, actually, or a form of it.
Does he have an account of, or does he call for a kind of plan for withdrawal, or is that not part of the public account? Maybe that would be very unpopular.
Right,
politician, so he couldn't do that.
That's the other thing. So what Tocqueville says about colonization cannot be taken out of context. And he begins with the colonial policy early on as a newly, right, sort of a new arrival in parliament. So he's very much constrained by the terms of the debate. And they are calls for withdrawal. This is or at least he has notes saying we cannot withdraw, suggesting that he's reflecting on people who maybe call for that. That's the commercial lobby who basically say, well, we have no interest there. You know, commercially, that's of no interest to us. We shouldn't be doing this. And so his whole argument is, well, commercial shouldn't be the most important argument. We have a political interest. And that's why we need to stay. But this whole deliberation or this whole discussion that I'm referring to is in the so-called essay on Algeria, which is not a published essay. It's something that he drafted after his first visit to the colony. He probably he shared it with Beaumont, that we know that, and Beaumont was supposed to write something on Algeria, but it's not published. So it's not something that he said anywhere publicly. And a lot of the critique of Tocqueville on Algeria is relying on this essay because it's blunt, it's not rhetorically sort of massaged or whatever. So, and yet even there he thinks about withdrawal and the possibility is what that would do to France, right? To France's public image and global standing. And he's saying, no, that's not an acceptable thing. But in very recently published, so Gallimard just published last year, two additional volumes with correspondence, I found a letter where he considers withdrawal. And that's in connection to this Eastern crisis that I analyzed in chapter two and the kind of falling out with Mill, supposedly, where he says, well, if we have a war in Europe, then we might consider withdrawing from Algeria, right? But we cannot simply withdraw without a reason. That's not what people do, right? Or that would have very, very severe implications for France's standing in the world, but also for the French self-understanding, what they think about their own nation, right? He's concerned about psychology all the time. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's great. Yeah, it's a great, great contribution to the discussion here. We're pretty much out of time, just maybe one or two minutes left. Maybe if you just have a few closing remarks on Tocqueville's applicability to the contemporary world. You conclude, I think, the last couple pages with a sort of Tocquevillian moderation, which might be a good place to end with. I mean, you've sort of highlighted in your book and here today the ways in which modern liberal democracies give rise to all sorts of dilemmas and tensions, and the best strategy, political strategy, really is to moderately try to manage them. So how do you think Tocqueville could speak to us today?
Well, partly what I'm trying to recover through Tocqueville is a somewhat different, I want to say richer, but perhaps different is a better word, liberalism than what typically is understood by a liberal position today. And liberalism is being caricatured successfully both by its opponents and proponents as being a fairly narrow set of doctrines. And partly what I'm trying to show is that maybe that's not the most productive way of thinking about liberalism. And then we should, first of all, see historically that it's much more a quarrel or a conversation or a different way of thinking about very hard dilemmas, right, that are really not easy. Well, maybe to recount them first, how to construe, how to understand equality and popular sovereignty. What is it that we mean by them? How do we how to institutionalize them or sort of make them work in an institutional setting, how to mobilize civic allegiance or national allegiance, which all democracies rely and need, right? And especially if you think about the aberrations of nationalism, right? Just to say, well, we don't want nationalism is not an answer, right? We need to have somehow a way to sustain civic allegiance and loyalty in an active participation and make people stay committed, and especially in order to cross partisan divides, right? That's the polarization, how to deal with polarization. Well, we have to remind people, well, we are in it together, right? Left, right, and center. And so there has to be aspects that reassure us or in our common citizenship, no matter what other, you know, disagreements we might have. We should try to agree to disagree, and that requires a common ground. And then how to negotiate these processes of globalization. I want to say that these dilemmas are really, they're not resolvable, right? They constantly need to be negotiated. They include trade-offs. And what I want to present through Tocqueville is a kind of vision of, well, I'm hesitating about the right word here, maybe more pragmatic, but less dogmatic, maybe this way, less dogmatic liberalism, that liberalism that's not driven by certain creeds like a religion, but liberalism that is committed to, yes, to values, but also it needs to understand soberly the difficulties of resolving any of these questions. And therefore the need to negotiate them and to have this kind of dynamic approach. So maybe in one closing statement, right, I say something like, if liberal democracy has a future, which I really hope it does, it is in recognizing the enduring dimensions, the deep sources of contemporary policy dilemmas, and in navigating these in a kind of imaginative rather than rigid ideological or partisan way. Just as liberal democracy should refuse to choose between equality and self-government or equality and freedom, right? That's no choice. That's not a real choice. We want both. So too, they ought to reject the false dichotomies of nationalism and democracy or sovereignty and globalization. And then, and if we reject them as democracy, as dichotomies, if we reject the either or, then we have to think about, okay, how do we reconcile these tensions? And that would have to be situational and imaginative, I imagine. But as I admit that I'm weak on policy so far, I need to think more about this.
Well, you've given a tremendous framework, I think, for contemporary liberal policymaking. So excellent book and excellent conversation. Eva, let me thank you again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you for the invitation. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.